Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Carlo Rotella. Carlo has written a book, fascinating book. It's called, long title, The World is Always Coming to an End. And we're going to find out about what that means, but it relates to a phenomenon of human history. The focal point starts off with the South Shore neighborhood in the city of Chicago. We have a unique connection, Carlo and I do, but I think you'll all enjoy the ride here. Again, with respect, Carlo Rotella. Carlo, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm absolutely fantastic. Great day. Fascinating book. Tell us, what is South Shore? I would back into this by asking about your background, but we'll see your background as we go through this. So tell me about South Shore.
South Shore is a neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. It's on the lakefront. It has long been known as one of the physically nicer parts of the south side, in some ways even of the city. It's a bedroom community, but it's in the middle of the inner city. It has been since the late 60s, an African-American neighborhood. And it is, unlike a lot of other neighborhoods in the country, it's a place where the haves and the have-nots live very near to each other, sometimes on the same block, sometimes separated by just an alley. So it is, on the one hand, it has an above-average number of PhDs for the city of Chicago. On the other hand, it has an above-average number of high school dropouts. It leads the city in both housing vouchers and evictions, but it also has a large cohort of middle-class and even upper-middle-class homeowners, and it has these beautiful green trim bungalow blocks. It has 1,011 exactly historic Chicago bungalows, so you have these lovely residential blocks, but then also these very desolate commercial strips, which have a lot of vacant storefronts and you know, sort of unemployed people hanging around. So it's a neighborhood of great contrast, which is 20 minutes from the Loop downtown. It's on the lakefront, next to Jackson Park, one of the great urban parks in America. The Obama Presidential Center is going to be built right near it. So there's a set of contrasts there that you don't often see in one place in America. We have all those contrasts in the country, but they tend to be physically separated from each other, whereas in South Shore, they're sort of right piled up on top of each other.
Well, for those people who do not know about Jackson Park or the lake, if they picture the city of Chicago as sort of a long, thin city built along Lake Michigan, and it's the north and south are split in downtown Chicago on State Street and Madison, and then the south side, bless the south side for this, numbers their east-west street by numbers. So you have 35th Street, 71st Street, and so on. And so what are the streets that on the north and south side form South Shore?
Now, the parameters in the neighborhood are very clear. So the eastern one is the lakefront. The western parameter is Stony Island Avenue. To the north, it's the bottom of Jackson Park, which is 67th Street. And then to the south, it's 79th Street. So it's a neighborhood of about 50,000 residents. At its height, it had over 80,000. So it is less dense than it used to be. It's about 9 miles south of the Loop, so it's quite close. You know, the outer drive goes right to it, so it's and there's public transportation, and so it's really right in the heart of the city. Most of Chicago is actually south of the Loop physically, in that sense, it's sort of in the middle of the city.
You and I have a special connection both to the community of South Shore and also, ironically, to each other, which I didn't know until I started to read this book. So. where were you raised, or what is your connection with South Shore?
So my parents, who were immigrants, graduate students at the University of Chicago, who met at the International House of the University of Chicago, moved there in 1967. In 1967, it was already clear that South Shore would soon be a black neighborhood. So when I was born in 1964, South Shore was still almost entirely white. By 1980, it was over 95% black, so that transformation happened quite quickly. And 1967 was sort of the peak year of the transformation. My parents had grown up. My father's from Sicily, although he grew up in Africa, in Eritrea. My mother's from Spain, from Barcelona. They were not particularly attuned to what Americans were worried about. They saw a bungalow that they could buy for, you know, a low price. I think they paid $22,000. In 1967, and it was near the University of Chicago. So we ended up in that neighborhood because my parents saw, you know, a nice place to live. And the sort of turmoil and the worry about white flight and all that stuff kind of slid off their backs. You know, they'd both been raised during wartime. They'd both been bombed, my father by the British Air Force, my mother by the German Air Force. And so their idea of trouble, they had a high bar for trouble. and so the sort of the white flight and the worry about, there was a spike in crime too, and South Shore didn't really worry them. And it was a lot of house for not a lot of money.
What kind of family did you have besides your parents? Did you have brothers, sisters?
So I have two brothers, Sebastian and Sal. So there were three brothers quite close in age, and like everyone over a certain age, the story of growing up in that neighborhood is that, you know, you leave the house in the morning and, you know, you come back for dinner. And in our case, you know, there's Jackson Park, which is this fabulous park, and we played, you know, in the alley, and I was a dead center field hitter when I was a little kid because we played in the little grassy space between two bungalows. We played baseball, so you had to hit the ball right back up the middle. And it was really this, and, you know, we get on our bikes and ride all the way up the lakefront, and it was a sort of green and idyllic place in that sense, but a lot of the sort of social turmoil slowly dawned on me as I got older, that, yeah, you know, that the neighborhood had completely turned over, that everybody was new, that there were these remnants of an older white neighborhood that were, you know, sort of receding, vanishing around me. The one I remember best is there was a bakery on 71st Street called the Amber Bakery that was a German-Dutch family. And because South Shore had been Irish and Jewish, especially in the past, they had always accentuated the Dutchness of their family and played down the Germanness because it was a problem. And they were still doing that in the 1970s, and I would go there, we'd get our birthday cakes there, and I, you know, sort of felt like telling them, like, I think it's probably okay to be German at this point. You know, no one cares anymore about the difference between Dutch and German. So I had these sort of indicators that there had been a previous layer in the neighborhood, that there had been other, you know, other groups of people there. But by the time I was kind of age and understanding, really this new order, which is Black South Shore, was all I knew. And that was the world I knew. And I had to discover that older South Shore from books and from sort of snooping around and from these little remnants of it.
Well, the connection between you and I is that you were raised on south of 71st Street on Oglesby Avenue, right?
That is correct, 7100 block of South Oglesby.
And I was on the 7300 block of South Oglesby. About,
which is where I got off the school bus, yeah.
Oh, is it really?
I know that block.
All right. Well, my grandparents, my story was this. My grandparents, back in around the turn of the century, going into the 1900s, may have even before, they had a choice to make when they first got married. They wanted to live in a, you know, they're out in the country, so to speak, which that's what South Shore was when they were coming in there. They looked at, and we're going to talk a little bit later about the South Shore Country Club, but they looked at the land, which is now the South Shore Cultural Center, used to be the South Shore Country Club. And they said, Grandpa said, should I buy that? Because it wasn't a club yet. That was 1904, I think, it was made into a club. Mm-hmm. But he was steered away from it because through South Shore Cultural Center / Country Club, there was, at that time, a platted road where gentlemen rode their horses and their carriages at high speed. Mm-hmm. And he was afraid that his brood of kids that he was had and is expecting more would get hurt by the horses. And so he and Grandma bought a large tract of land south of 71st Street, south of 73rd Street on Oglesby Avenue. And then it gradually was broken up and sold off to different folks. But they maintained a home there and gardens. Grandma gardened like mad on into the 1950s. Eventually, Grandpa died, and Grandma lived there for a little bit longer and then eventually sold because she was not able physically to care for the place.
Mm-hmm.
And moved out to an assistant care facilities out in the suburbs. But after the war and during the war, we were, as kids, because the men were off fighting in the Europe or the Pacific, and the their spouses were staying back at home, coming back from their separate lives and coming to... back to Oglesby. So a group of the kids were there, and that's where I spent a number of years during war and also a bit afterwards. So I went to St. Philip Near Eye School, which is one of the focal points of South Shore, one of the buildings and the school system. But I also went to Bryn Mawr, which we could talk about a little bit later. It's a public school nearby. And mm-hmm. my mother taught at O'Keefe School. So we had a connection to several different parts of the community. And I was a spray hitter. Now, you might ask, why a spray hitter? Because we used to play ball in the street. And I learned that if I can hit the ball a little bit to the right or a little bit to the left, that whoever went to catch it would run into a car.
Yeah, that's car. Exactly.
And so I'd get an extra hit that way, you know. We did that with both softball and also football, come to think of it. And so I have a lot
of interest. I played a lot of two-on-two touch football in the street. In the age before, when you could just say, oh, there's a car coming and stop. And,
exactly.
You always sound old when you say things were different. But one thing that was actually different then is there was literally less than 50% as much traffic on city streets back then, so that it was actually possible to do that. You know, that you just say, "Oh, a car's coming," and you need to go stand on the side.
And one of the other things I remember, just to set another parallel to us, is that I used to ride my bicycle up from the South Shore. On up to the Museum of Science and Industry. I think one summer I probably was there 20 times, and I would spend the whole day there by myself. Nobody, you know, no one guarding me, no one helicoptering, parenting over me. And I would park my bike outside the museum, and when I came out, it was there. There was no thought in those days that there was something unusual. That was just the ordinary course of things. And the final thing is, in reading your book, you talked about public transportation, and one of the distinctive parts of the South Shore area was the Illinois Central Electric train, which came through right down 71st Street towards the lake, and it was a very efficient, inexpensive way to get connected and taken to the downtown area.
And it's also, one of the things I'm really interested in is sort of the deep imprint that mm-hmm. the place where you grow up leaves on you. And I think that train is really of outsized importance to people who grow up there in many ways. I mean, first of all, the tracks go through, you know, they're in the middle of 71st Street at grade, which would be the way that trains went through cities in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this really strong presence of this form of transportation that feels a little archaic, you know, feels a little old school. But also just then late at night, right, freights will come through, long freights would come through back then.
Mm-hmm.
But also just this, it's a reminder, it's some of the bones or the arteries of industrial Chicago. You know, that train is going down to South Chicago and then to the East Side, which was one of the great concentrations of steel mills anywhere in the world. And you know, obviously when you're a kid, when I was a kid, I didn't feel it this way, but as I got older, I realized what it was, is this is 19th century Chicago, this is industrial Chicago, the railroad and the steel mills and all that, and I was really growing up in a moment when that city was becoming obsolescent, but there's this really strong presence, you know, just in the physical landscape, the sort of physical container that your life is poured into, of this older city. And it's one of the things that train really was one of the things that got me interested in the idea that neighborhoods accrue in layers, that, you know, you peel back the layer that you live in, there's another one underneath, and that other one might have a different way of life, and, you know, different ways of making money, different ways of being a man or a woman, different ways of having fun, different kinds of parenting, as you say. And so that train did a lot of work for me as a kid, and it does a lot of work for me in the book.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Carlo Rotella, who is the author of the book, The World is Always Coming to an End. And that there's a really interesting anecdote which gives him the title about this book. We're talking about principally the South Shore neighborhood in the city of Chicago. But we're going to talk about extrapolating to other neighborhoods, to the concept of neighborhood, and his study, which is very interesting, about how we define neighborhoods and how they change and what are the effects on people. So this is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we'll take a break. We'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Carlo Rotella. Carlo is a fellow who was raised on at least part of his life in the south side of Chicago in the South Shore area, as was I. And we've been talking about so far about contacts that we had in common. But we're going to talk now about his own personal observations about neighborhoods, and what are neighborhoods, and how are they replicated in this unique place called South Shore. This is John Smetanka. So, Carlo, I set the table and the tee ball for you. What got you started to writing this book, and then how did you approach it? What did you find?
Mm-hmm. Well, my ambition was not so much to write about South Shore as to do a neighborhood. You know, in Chicago, the city of Chicago has this great tradition of books about a single neighborhood. And, you know, the most famous on the scholarly side is the Chicago School of Sociology that, you know, for a century now, the sociology department of the University of Chicago has been sending out students, graduate students and faculty going out to do studies of individual neighborhoods. And if you were to read all those books, you would have a fabulous portrait of a city and how it works and how a neighborhood works. But there's also, you know, the poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks, you know, A Street in Bronzeville, or the short stories of Stuart Dybeck. Chicago has this really strong tradition of writing neighborhood, and sort of following what the Italian crime writer Andrea Camilleri says, which is, you know, tell the story of your village, and if you've told it well, you will have told the story of the world. If you really zero in on a neighborhood and really get the neighborhood right, you can address the kind of larger principles, the larger things that are happening. And for me, one of the really big ones is that, you know, the sort of phrase that's stuck in my head is, we live in neighborhoods and neighborhoods live in us. And by we live in neighborhoods, I mean that I've been reading a lot of archaeology, a lot of study of ancient cities, and basically they have never found a human settlement that didn't have neighborhoods in it. You know, neighborhoods are a human universal. Wherever people settle, not just in cities, but refugee camps, military bases, anywhere, the Burning Man thing they do out in the desert, they make neighborhoods. Either the government imposes it from above, or people just create them from below. So we live in neighborhoods means that neighborhoods are kind of a universal of human experience. And neighborhoods live in us, which is the thing I really want to get at in the book, is that neighborhoods leave a deep imprint on us, not just in our life course, although they do. You know, the neighborhood, there's a whole study in sociology called neighborhood effects that studies the effect of neighborhood, and that means you tease apart the influence of neighborhood from overlapping things like race or income. And they keep finding more things that neighborhood shapes, not just, you know, like, you know, birth weight or educational attainment, stuff you can measure quantitatively, but also things like your level of altruism, your sensitivity to disorder, your cynicism about the law. You know, these things that we think of as character, but in fact are influenced by neighborhood effects. So one of the things I wanted to do is I wanted to, digging into my own life, but also interviewing a lot of people in South Shore, I wanted to sort of trace the imprint of the neighborhood, the way that the neighborhood lives inside of people, and then also the reverse, see how people live in this neighborhood, and especially how they do the things that neighborhoods require, like how they get together to try and solve problems, or how it can be difficult for them to get together to solve problems. So in all those ways, I was really interested in writing a book about neighborhood and how it works. And South Shore is my guinea pig, my case study. It's the place, you know, I know best. It's a place I spent, you know, many years studying, quote unquote, when I was a kid, even though I didn't know that's what I was doing. And then I spent another, you know, couple decades in the recent past going back and interviewing people and digging in the archives and finding out more about it.
When I was a kid, when I was living there, it was virtually, as far as I knew, I never thought anything of the fact that it was all white, that a lot of different groups. In fact, one of the interesting things that I found in terms of separation of groups is we had, there was a certain amount of the older families who had been around were not Irish, not Polish, not Catholic, but they were not Italian. They were kind of like Anglo-Saxon, and there was a certain social difference between that crew and these newcomers, you know, the Irish, the Polish, and so on. That was, it did focus your attention on differences, class differences, or whatnot.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the big questions in the book is how to tease out the interrelationship, but also to separate to racial and class difference, and to which you've just added ethnic difference, I think, which is also important in the history of the neighborhood. And if you look at the history of the neighborhood over time, it's a series of successions. You know, it's a nice place to live, and it's in the middle of the city, so various groups come along, see it's a nice place to live, want to live there. So they have to sort of elbow their way in among others who are more or less receptive to their presence. And you're talking about two layers, that is WASPs, and then the white ethnics, in other words, immigrant white ethnics, usually a couple generations removed from the actual immigrant generation. So there's that, you know, sort of older tension. And then also there's sort of the larger tension you might think of as an analytical tension, which is say, well, what's the definitive, what's the difference that matters most? You know, is it racial or ethnic, or is it class? And that's one of the reasons that I think it's interesting to look at South Shore now, because it's a black neighborhood. You know, almost everyone I dealt with is African American. And there's this profound class divide in the neighborhood, so that sometimes you look at it from one angle and you say, listen, and when I say you, I also mean the voices of the people I talk to in the book. They say, look, class is the way to understand this. And then you turn around and see it from another angle, and people say, no, you got to understand that racial, you know, the continuing fact of racial segregation is the most important thing. And the reason that there are black haves and black have-nots living next to each other is because we still have continuing racial segregation, they're sort of jammed on top of each other, right? And that's one of the things I really pursued in the book, is just to sort of to understand how these factors kind of overlay each other and sort of are intricately tangled up with each other, in a way that, you know, as you say, you know, you're sort of vaguely aware of as you live there, and then as you look back on it in time, then you can really see these kind of large movements of people over time. And they're not just movements of ethnic groups. They're also movements in class. South Shore has traditionally been a neighborhood where a family buys its first house, where a family either moves up into the middle class or, if they're already in the middle, aims higher. And that move is just getting harder to do in this country now. And so it is not fulfilling that traditional function as much as it did. There's this wider and wider class divide in which the haves stay the haves and the have-nots stay the have-nots. And that's really different. And that, in some ways, that's a bigger difference than, if you think about your South Shore and the one I grew up in and South Shore now, that's a bigger difference than the, you know, the racial difference.
Mm-hmm. So there is in this area that you have described, 50,000 people living in it over several square, maybe a couple of square miles, several
it's
square
that,
miles.
Between three and four, yeah.
Yeah. And in that area, in that block, there are not just a single form of housing.
That's right.
You're talking. You mentioned 1,000 bungalows. By the way, just for the record, for our overseas listeners, what is a bungalow?
So I will not do justice to the official definition, which is the Chicago Bungalow Association scrupulously maintains. But it's essentially it's a style of house, and in order to be a historic Chicago bungalow, it has to have been built, you know, in a certain period in the early 20th century. But it's sort of an offset front door and a overhanging roof, and it's got to be longer than it is wide. You know, there's a set of distinctions, and what they really are these fairly compact, affordable. Sort of machines for producing middle classness. You know, there's 80,000 of these in the city of Chicago, mm-hmm. and they're really Chicago's best insurance policy for having some sort of a middle class. So bungalows, there are, so in South Shore, there are bungalows owned by police officers, you know, nurses, bus drivers, postal workers, but there's also lawyers, doctors, professors. The bungalow really sort of houses the whole spectrum of the middle, from basically the upper working class to the sort of upper middle class, right?
Now within that area, though, however, you got the bungalows. We've talked about that
right.
now. But that's the middle class, so to speak, quote unquote. But
right.
you also have the other ends of the spectrum as well.
So, right. So if you think of it this way, that 70% of the land area of the neighborhood is occupied by single family houses. But 75% of the people in the neighborhood live in apartments, right? Mm-hmm. So you have all these walk-up apartment buildings, courtyard buildings, or other kinds of walk-up buildings that are much more densely, much more densely populated. And as I said before, South Shore leads the city in housing vouchers. So in order to be to have a low enough income to qualify for a housing voucher, you have to be poor, right? So there's also blocks of these apartments. And some chunks of the neighborhood are just these apartments, and then there's a couple other things. So if that's at the lower end, then there's high-rise apartment buildings along South Shore Drive, looking out over the lake. They have spectacular views of Lake Michigan, and that is higher, more upper middle. And then there's this 4x4 square block section of South Shore called the Jackson Park Highlands, which is these big, beautiful, architecturally distinctive houses on large lots. This chunk of South Shore is cul-de-sac'd on almost every street where it touches the rest of the neighborhood, and it really is one of the most beautiful neighborhoods you'll ever see. My family moved from a bungalow to the Jackson Park Highlands in the mid-70s, and I think of that house, so these houses in the Jackson Park Highlands might cost you as much as $400,000 or $500,000, you know, and you just pick up one of those houses and move it to where I live in Boston, and now it's, $4 or $5 million. So you have a great range of housing, a great range of class difference, and you can see there are many reasons why the commercial streets are desolate, but one reason is think about what kind of a business would cater to all those people, right?
Yeah, right.
It's very hard to think. So the South Shore's only supermarket, which was a Dominick's, a kind of middle-of-the-road supermarket, closed in 2013. When the whole Dominick's chain collapsed. And it has still not to this day been replaced. And you can see why. A Whole Foods would look at the neighborhood and say there's too many poor people. But, you know, a Save-A-Lot would look at the neighborhood and say there's too many wealthy people.
Each one of those conditions would deter that particular kind of store, Save-A-Lot versus Whole Foods, would deter them from making a buck. Right.
So they see it as like, well, there's not enough of our kind of people, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the ways in which South Shore is not a typical neighborhood, but it's actually in some ways more typical of the nation, in that as the middle, that bungalow-dwelling middle class ages out and hollows out and isn't really being replaced. These are people who had one job working for one company or working for the government and a pension, you know, which is all sounds incredibly obsolescent now, right? Mm-hmm. And they're in their 70s, you know, and they're not really being replaced by a young middle class in the same way. As that middle recedes, you have a neighborhood of haves and have-nots. And the haves have educational and professional credentials, and the have-nots don't have them and are unlikely to get them. And in some ways, that's more a mirror of the nation as the middle sort of shrinks and hollows out and is feels squeezed from both above and below than it is a mirror of other neighborhoods, because it's actually kind of atypical. Most haves in this country, especially white ones, have succeeded in putting a lot more distance between themselves and the have-nots than is the case in South Shore. And that's because of the persistent fact of racial segregation, is that the black middle class and upper middle has been less successful in separating itself from the have-nots. And so in South Shore, you can get a kind of a picture of what our country's going to look like when we're done getting rid of the middle class, which we've been working on for about 40 years, because they're all in one place. Right, and it's harder to do in the rest of the country because it's more like you know, whole communities would be haves or have-nots.
Well, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, I want to tease out some of the terms that you use, which are really interesting because they're descriptive of the concepts that are useful not only for the South Shore area but neighborhoods around the world. So, this is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we're talking to a fascinating guy, Carlo Rotella, who wrote a book called The World Is Always Coming to an End. And we're teasing to the end to have him tell us where he got that phrase. But we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Carlo Rotella, the author of the new book, The World Is Always Coming to an End. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. And Carlo, when we broke, you were describing this conflict that is as the middle class in America, if it continues to deteriorate, to go out of existence, this city, Chicago, with all its former neighborhoods, may be something like a relic of the Roman Empire in terms of neighborhoods that are identifiable, eh?
Well, I think what happens is that, you know, what happens in other cities is that it tends to shake out as one or the other, right? So cities like Boston and San Francisco are basically turning into islands of haves, right? Mm-hmm. But Chicago, in part because of its industrial history and in part because of these 80,000 bungalows, really has a strong tradition of neighborhoods in which the middle class takes the lead, as was very much the case in South Shore, takes the lead in determining what are the priorities of this neighborhood, what are we going to pursue, you know, how are we going to go about getting together to solve problems. And so as that middle class ages out and hollows out, it gets harder for the neighborhood to do those traditional things in the way it has in the past. And so in that sense, obviously there are still going to be neighborhoods and Chicago's still going to be there. But the question is, how are neighborhoods going to work if you take away that active, vibrant, dynamic middle that has done so much work in the city?
Now, you use a phrase, the first word, I should say, is container. You use that with a very specific concept in mind, and others you talked about internal issues, that is family or the people, which and the culture. And culture was the other another aspect. How do how do you put all those together? Tease them apart.
So container, I use container because, so usually when we talk about neighbor, the word neighborhood has these warm and fuzzy connotations, and almost always when we, and by me, we, I mean scholars and journalists, just casual conversation, when we talk about neighborhood, we usually talk about the community. We talk about a group of people and their relationships to each other. you know, neighbors and neighboring. And I use the term container in the book to describe the other way of thinking about a neighborhood, which is as a physical landscape, you know, a man-made, man-carpentered landscape. And I think we really underrate the importance of the container, the way it shapes the community. So think of the container as a vessel, as a container into which the community is poured, and the community takes the shape of the container. And I also think the container has a deep, deep effect on the imprint it leaves and the psyches and the mentalities and the sensibilities of the people who live there. And what's happened in South Shore is, as the middle class has receded from public life, many people I talk to have transferred some of their investment of themselves, of their resources and their time and their energy and their sentiments. They've transferred those investments from the community to the container. You know, they've lavished attention on their backyard, on their house. They love Jackson Park. They love the lakefront. They really deeply connect to the physical neighborhood. And sometimes that's because they've taken some of those resources away from deeply connecting to community. So one of the reasons I use container and community as two ways to think about neighborhood is because it really helps explain some of what's happened in South Shore, where there's been this kind of retreat from public life. But people are still really passionate about the neighborhood. But often what they're passionate about is their relationship to the physical neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Now, you used a couple of other concepts and compared and contrasted with other neighborhoods in the city of Chicago, but I think we can use this as a paradigm for relationships around the world. And that is, the difference is, how do they work within that container? How does the community work with passion? Is it group-oriented, or is it isolated?
So there's a couple ways I think about it in the book, and one of the ideas I found really useful is this idea of a community of limited liability. That is, that people really care about their neighborhood and they invest deeply in their neighborhood, but it's not an all-consuming absolute commitment. And if the neighborhood is not providing something or not rewarding them in some way, they will transfer that allegiance to something else, right? So one of the things I look at is, well, how do people get together? And how do people get together to solve problems? And what kind of problems do they think are worth solving? And one of the things that really struck me in the history of South Shore, there were a series of events in the 1970s when people, neighbors in South Shore, really did get together to solve problems. And all of them had some relation to the physical landscape. So one of the big ones you've already mentioned was, there was this Fancy Wasp Country Club, South Shore Country Club. It folded in the 70s. And people in the neighborhood got together and fought for decades to stop the city from tearing down the old country. First, to force the city to buy it, then to stop the city from tearing it down, and then to turn it into the South Shore Cultural Center, which is this beloved public amenity.
And which you can see if you watch the movie The Blues Brothers, because part
Absolutely.
Of it was filmed there.
Yeah, there was the outdoor shot, the climactic concert, the interior is not the cultural center, but the exterior is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Obamas had their wedding reception there. I mean, it's involved in life in many ways in the neighborhood. So look at that example. So that's an example where people in the neighborhood decided it was worth it to spend a lot of their resources, money, energy, time, passion, sentiment, get together to force the government to do something with a piece of the landscape. And that has happened more than once. Another big one was the neighborhood got together and voted 75th Street dry. There was the city's most notorious tavern crawl was on 75th Street. And in the 1970s, they voted it dry and dismantled this set of taverns. You know, I was digging around in the archives, reading, you know, letters to the editor saying that, you know, our mail delivery has been rendered unsteady by the fact that our mailmen, you know, are getting dragged into these taverns and not making their rounds. And, there was this sense that this tavern strip was kind of a threat to this, you know, bungalow-dwelling middle-class life. And so the neighbors got together to solve that problem. So clearly there have been times when people in South Shore found that common cause and got together to solve problems, but what you see is that it has usually been the middle class, and they've usually been, in some sense, deciding on a piece of the landscape, what needs to be there or what needs to not be there, and its relation to their homes.
A little bit of personal saga from my family history. I was too young to remember this, but I'm told that when I was a baby, my mom and dad got a babysitter during the day because they were both working. And that babysitter went out and took me out in a carriage. Mom thought that was great, rolling up and down 79th Street. But what she didn't know until later was that this lady was taking me in carriage into bars up and down 79th Street and to preach against drinking. So she was a
great
little Carrie Nation, and I was a little object lesson for these poor people in drinking and during the daytime at 79th Street.
You were a prop, basically.
I was a
right?
prop. You was.
Well, the thing to remember about 71st, 75th, and 79th is they're old-fashioned main streets.
Yeah.
You know, there's bars, restaurants, drugstores. You can get, you know, it's still even when I was a kid. You know, we got our birthday cakes and my sneakers, and you know, went to the movies and all that stuff was on 71st Street. So 71st, 75th, 79th, they were these old-fashioned, you know, main streets, and they really suffered not only because of white flight, but also because of the rise of malls and big box stores, and
sure.
They became obsolescent.
We had it was a phenomenon which was not unique to South Shore, but I believe it was also a factor in part of the factor in white flight. I know that it was the case in another adjunct area, and that is Blockbusters, realtors, and developers, whoever, would prey upon the fear or the uncertainty of the unknown in the ethnic or white community about African Americans moving in, and it was really brutal. In fact, I was of an age during one of these calls came into my aunt who was living just on the other side of Stony Island, and she was outraged because this person was calling and warning her that the blacks are coming in, and you know, you get out while you can. We'll sell your house now. And I heard her say to this guy, you know, get off my phone. You're not scaring me. And it was just a very vivid. At this time, I can still remember that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's this really interesting literature, and again, as you say, it's not just South Shore, but it happens to be a particularly robust one of South Shore, of people of looking back after they've left. So this is sort of the white ethnics, Jewish, Irish, and others who left in the 50s and 60s and are looking back from the suburbs, basically, at South Shore, and looking back at exactly this process of, you know, like, well, sort of why they left, and did they kind of cut and run too early, and, you know, how important was blockbusting, and, you know, and it's a quite soul-searching literature. You know, more than one of these is asking, well, was I a racist? And, you know, part of what makes this complicated is that the first black families moving in the 60s, on average, had a little more money and a little more education than the white families that they were replacing. So the initial panic really has to be seen as a racial panic, because there was no class difference, and if there was, the black newcomers actually were slightly higher. There were, you know, sort of followed by the black poor. And if you look back, it's the same neighborhoods going way back into the 20th century. That is, the first, the white ethnics, then middle-class blacks, then lower-class blacks are all coming from Woodlawn and Englewood and the same set of neighborhoods, Washington Park, which are further inland on
That's
the south
right.
side.
Yes.
And that they're sort of feeder zones, sending people to South Shore, which was sort of and still has this quality of being this kind of Valhalla by the lakefront, you know, this sort of the where you're aiming for if you're a Southsider. And that really hasn't changed. You know, part of what the book is about and thinking about neighborhood is, even as there have been so many successions and so many transformations, there are these deep persistences in the neighborhood. And one is this kind of respectable tone and this idea that South Shore is a uniquely nice place to live that really has been consistent on the South Side for a long time.
Is it still?
It is, although South Shore also has this outsized reputation for violence and especially for shootings. And again, it's part of this, you know, that it is at least two different neighborhoods sharing one container, is that there are a lot of homicides. There are a lot of shootings in South Shore. They're almost never the killing of a bungalow-dwelling middle-class person. They're, you know, the people who get killed tend to be poor people.
Unless it's a family situation.
It's happening near the middle-class parts of the neighborhood, but it's not happening necessarily to the middle-class parts of the neighborhood.
I was going to say, in the bungalows, those kinds of homicides or assaults tend to be because they're domestic relations as opposed to outsiders coming in to raid the place.
And there's also no more of those than there are anywhere else in the city. I mean, you know, so what there are a lot of, you know, kind of the gangs. Even the idea of gangs is kind of outmoded. That's more of a 1990s thing. The gangs kind of came apart, and really it's kind of smaller cliques hanging out on corners. And, you know, one of the big reasons for shootings now is like social media insults, right? Things that happen online. So it's not even like gangs fighting over drug turf or anything like that. So, yes, there's an extraordinary amount of violence in South Shore, considering how nice the neighborhood looks, or at least some of its blocks do. Mm-hmm. But South Shore has not lost that reputation, which means that when these things happen, people in the neighborhood are doubly outraged because their feeling is, hey, look, if it's happening here, you know, and this is supposed to be a cut above, you know, what's the rest of the world like?
Is there today, and maybe we'll take a break at this point, but when we come back, is there today a spirit of cooperation in South Shore among the various elements in that community that bodes well or bodes ill for the future? This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to Carlo Rotella, who wrote a fascinating book called The World is Always Coming to an End. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Carlo Rotella, who is the author of a book, The World is Always Coming to an End, talking about the South Shore neighborhood as a study point for how neighborhoods can function and do function, and its their components. So, Carlo, I asked the question, how does this spirit right now of community thrive or not thrive in this particular South Shore neighborhood?
Well, I'd preface it by saying, you know, I've been doing interviews there for the last couple decades, and as far as I can tell, there are just as many people of goodwill who are eager to invest themselves in the neighborhood and work with their neighbors. So that hasn't changed. I think what has changed is the structural conditions in which they're working. That is, that the class divide in the neighborhood makes it harder to do that. And it makes it harder to do that because it's harder to get together across that class divide. So if you're going to get together, first you have to decide what a problem is, right? And which ones you should try to solve first. So even the good things that happen in the neighborhood are received in different ways depending which side of the divide you're on. As I said, the Obama Presidential Center, the Obama Library, is being built in Jackson Park right next to South Shore. So if you own property in South Shore, especially the northern part of South Shore, you know, you're looking at increased property values. But if you pay rent, then you're looking at higher rents, which is the opposite of good news. And I think it's harder to find an issue that everybody agrees needs to be dealt with. And I think the story of the supermarket is a great example of that. Everybody has to eat, obviously, but our foodways are so niched by class and taste these days that everybody has to eat is not as unifying an idea as it used to be. And so it was hard to get people together. And I think, you know, I spent a lot of time with leaders in the community, both elected and activists, and in each in their way is trying to figure out how to work across this class divide and trying to find what's the right issue, what's the right way of addressing people that will get people organized. And none of them, you know, they candidly tell me none of them has found it yet. They have not found that issue that will get the bungalow owner and the person who lives in an apartment and pays the rent with a housing voucher together to say, okay, this is important and we're going to invest ourselves in this.
Well, you know, there's, as I was trying to sketch from my own mind the thoughts that you had in this book, and again, I strongly recommend to people, even if they have no connection to the South Shore area whatsoever, to read this book, because it gives a good picture of how neighborhoods and people organize neighborhoods function, and how they can dysfunction, how they can do well and how they can do poorly. But I was reading it, I got the impression that there is a tension in between several different possible alternative results. Mm-hmm. When there is a change or a struggle in a neighborhood where it is no longer, quote, stable or the same that it was over 5 or 10 years. And it seems to me that there's two, and you talk about a phrase called community efficiency. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, so that's where people get together and work together.
Right.
And they consider themselves invested not only in their own home, a fortress, if they otherwise, or but they want to look at the community as a whole, whether it's the container concept of neighborhood, or it is the community itself, mm-hmm. what is the whole batch of people. And the other possibility is, once they get isolated, if they give up on community, you end up with fortress mentality for themselves and anarchy. And I use that anarchy as a way of catching people's attention. I'm not saying that the South Shore or any other place is a total anarchy situation. However, where that focus on pulling up the drawbridge and mm-hmm. letting the problems of the world try to get across your moat. That's what I'm talking about in isolation. So mm-hmm. am I accurately catching some of the flavor of your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yes, so that is the tension, right? Do you decide, you know, we are not going to be able to get together, but I need to look out for mine? Or do you say, the best way to look out for my own stuff, my own castle, is to get together with my neighbors? And there is certainly a track record of doing that in South Shore, but as I've said, what distinguishes those successful campaigns is that the middle class took the lead. Mm-hmm. And the less of a middle class you have, and the older it is, you know, what we're talking about, when I say the middle class, we're talking about that post-World War II middle class that grew larger in the 50s and the 60s. And so we're talking government workers, middle managers, but we're also talking working class people, good union jobs working on the line in factories. That middle class has been either stagnant or shrinking for decades now. And those people are not as involved in the neighborhood as they were. They've gotten older. They're less out there. And so if you're asking, well, which future do you see?
I'm asking that for
you. I would sort of throw it back to the people in the neighborhood, and I'll say there's a couple futures that they talk about a lot. So there's a lot of worry about gentrification in the neighborhood. And by gentrification, they mean white people moving into the neighborhood. And there's an enormous amount of worry about it, because it's a beautiful neighborhood, housing is relatively inexpensive, it's close to the loop. But there's statistically not much sign of it. The reputation of South Shore for violence and the availability of other neighborhoods has really, it's kind of a trickle. But I do think that what could happen is that the middle class, of the have portion of the neighborhood, could slowly become whiter. That is, young white families buying bungalows, and you're starting to see some of that. And yet, there's no indication that the have-not part of the neighborhood is going to be anything other than have-nots of color for any time to come. However, large financial combines have been buying up those apartment buildings in South Shore and you know, harvesting the money to be had from the federal government through the housing vouchers. But you do, when you look at those buildings, you can see a future in which those companies then kick out all the housing voucher holders, condoize, and sell those apartments to white families. So that's one future that could happen, the sort of white gentrification. There are others, it's entirely unclear exactly how this is going to work, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen slowly, as far as I can tell. For people who live in places like Boston and New York, where there's so much population pressure and money pressure, it's hard to picture The lack of it on the south side of Chicago, there's many fewer people there than there were before. Chicago's losing population every year. In the world that I was moving in the South Shore, a lot of families move down south or back south, either back to the kind of Mississippi where a lot of families came from, or to Atlanta. A lot of people are excited about retiring down there. And so because there isn't this intense pressure, you know, anything that happens is going to happen slowly, a little bit at a time. And what happens is that the people I talk to, anytime they see a change, they tell me about it, you know. So my best sources knew every young white couple that had bought a bungalow within 10 blocks in any direction, right? Because they're very alert. They've got their antenna out for what's changing and how's it changing. The larger question you're asking, whether collective efficacy or sort of fording up in the castle is going to win out, I can't tell you. There's so many factors that, including the new mayor of Chicago, there's so many factors that could tip it one way or the other. There could be an issue that comes along, or some clever activists and leaders could figure out a way to mobilize everybody in the neighborhood around one thing. And I just, you know, I can't see it at the moment, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
Like several weeks ago, in preparation for talking to you, I drove back through the old neighborhood and visited some people who are friends of mine now who live in the old house that I was raised in. And mm-hmm. I drove up and down 71st Street and with the old shopping area. And I had some of those same memories. I went to the movies at the Hamilton and the Jeffrey mm-hmm. and whatnot. And as I drove up and down, it was like, I won't say a war zone. That's not accurate. But it was depressing. There were not many people out on the street. Stores were in transition in or out of business.
Yeah, a lot of vacant storefronts.
Well, at any rate, I then drove up, and I was going to a meeting in the Merchandise Mart, and as I drove north on South Shore Drive and into Lakeshore Drive, I didn't make the right turn that I should have to get off, and I ended up going up to the 3200 block of Lakeshore Drive and started mm-hmm. trickling down through the neighborhood. And I went through places like Old Town and whatever else, the DePaul neighborhood and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I was stunned by the difference in the number of people on the street in the north side versus 71st Street. But here's the thing that struck me. I saw frowns on the people on 71st Street. And all these scores and thousands of people I saw on the north side walking around with their families and whatnot, I saw frowns. I don't think that there was a feeling. It was a beautiful day, so they weren't being rained on. But I think that people are essentially the same. Down deep inside, they're the same. Whether they're white, black, green, yellow, whatever, rich or poor, when it comes to basic human emotions, when it comes to how their internals turn into culture, their own culture, that's a different story, and into communities. Unfortunately, we're coming close to the end of our time here. And for I love this book, and I talked to you for hours, but now I've got to come to pay up. What is the title, the origin of this title? The world is always coming to an end.
Well, you mentioned the guy. There's a real estate man named Alan Hamilton who developed a lot of 71st Street and owned a lot of property there. And in 1969, he was interviewed by the Daily News in Chicago at the peak of the transformation from a white to a black neighborhood. And he took the long view in this interview, and he said, listen, you know, when the Irish came, the English thought the world was coming to an end. And then when the Jews came, the Irish thought the world was coming to an end. And then he said something interesting. He says, we are black now. And, you know, he was essentially talking to the business owners who were his tenants on 71st Street. And he was saying, don't panic. You know, black people's money spends just the same as white people's money. And, you know, the neighborhood keeps changing, and it keeps remaining a kind of middle-class, respectable neighborhood. And you know, don't panic. You can still make money here. Which is great and sounds very enlightened, but then he sold all his property on 71st Street, and I thought that kind of rich irony captured it really well. Which is that his point was that succession is normal And, you know, in other words, succession change, the idea that your neighborhood is always sort of, you know, in motion under your feet, is itself a form of persistence because it's always true.
All right.
But then he looked out for number one, right? Which people do.
Carlo, thank you very much for a wonderful discussion about our old neighborhood, but more important about neighborhoods around the world, things we can extrapolate and maybe learn, no matter where we live.
Thanks Again. So much for having me, John. I really enjoyed
Great.
It.
The name of his book is The World is Always Coming to an End. Remember, this is With Respect. We're on every Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. And our mantra is, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.